I am delighted and honored to represent this congregation's ministry today as your guest minister. And I thank Gretchen. I think she's hiding someplace in the back for the invitation. And if there's anything that I say that you do not like, take it up with her. I hate dry sermons. We religious liberals wish to invest in that which is noble. But like most humans, we want to see immediate results from our investment. We want to know that what we're doing counts. And this is a valid expectation. However, it can lead to a trap that is counterproductive to the very desire that we have. This trap is to make our primary investments in symptoms rather than causes, because the effect of symptoms is immediate to our vision. Here's an example. We see hungry people, so we participate in projects that lessen their hunger. We feel good about our participation because we can see immediate results. However, we have not addressed the cause of this hunger, and it becomes necessary to continue feeding hungry people. Now, I've not said that it's wrong to feed the hungry. Certainly, we should invest in such endeavors to uplift the quality of life for our neighbors. What I'm illustrating is that unless we address the causes of their hunger, it will remain a project without end. The question is, what has this to do with the purpose of religion? And I suggest everything. Emil Brunner suggests that the church exists by mission as fire exists by burning. In other words, no mission, no fire. Here's the problem. Because of our liberal desire to see immediate results from our investments, we have tended to ignore our real religious mission in favor of substituting other missions that visibly gratify our sense of immediate investment. The two most popular of these substitutes have been creating community. However, while community is vital in our movement, community for the sake of itself is no stronger than the fragility of the egos involved and can be nothing more than an embracing haven for frustrated liberals. And the second and primary one is doing social action. However, while social action is an imperative in our movement, it can be nothing more than an activity that temporarily relieves the guilt of theological irrelevance and social impotence. There are two essential problems with such substitutes. First, they are symptoms of causes and thus are never finally relieved. And second, by focusing only on symptoms, we remain confused about the causes that produce the symptoms. We actually come to believe that we're making a difference. And while this may be true in an immediate and limited scale, it is not true on a long-term and larger scale. And this is one major reason why nothing ever seems to change despite our best efforts. The question that confronts us is, what is the mission of religion? There are several clues that can lead us to an insightful definition, I believe. The first clue is found in the type of institution for which a congregation is created. It is society that creates the institutions required to serve its needs. And the type of institution it creates defines that institution's social mission. A governmental institution is created to serve society's political needs, an educational institution to serve society's learning needs, a financial institution to serve society's economic needs, and a medical institution to serve its health needs. And a religious institution is created to serve society's meaning needs. This religious mission, contrary to popular belief, is not up for grabs, as any of society's institutions' mission is up for grabs. Society did not say that all religions have the same mission except Unitarian Universalists, and they can decide what they wish it to be. But that's where we are. What this clue reveals is that the mission of all religion has been the same since society created this institution. Now, the second clue comes from the circumstance that provoked the birth of the religious institution. Seems obvious that the first institution society created was the family, and the second was community to house families. And it was out of the needs of these two original institutions that all the other institutions emerged. It is possible, and I think it not only possible, but is true because I believe it, that the next institutional need created was that what we of the modern world call religion. Back when we lived in caves, there was little to ponder except a mystifying and terrifying environment. But then came art and language, howsoever primitive, and meaning-making was born. Critical to this meaning-making were answers to the compelling questions inherent in the mystery of the cave clan's environment. So there arose an institution in the midst of the community which function was to enter this mystery and return with answers that made sense of human existence. Thus, the meaning of life institution was born. The implied mission of religion then is to give meaning to human existence and direction to human community. Meaning to human existence, direction to human community. Now, at first, this institution seems to have been a single person that was called by many different names, shaman, witch doctor, priest, etc. And maybe it happened this way. One morning, the leader of the cave clan said, "Joe, while the rest of us go out and hunt and gather, you sit on this big rock over here and ponder what this whole big mess we're in is all about." And so Joe sat on the rock and pondered and sought to penetrate life's mysteries and make sense of existence. And the community wanted to know Joe's conclusions and in turn did its own pondering. And given the passage of time, this pondering enterprise grew in importance and power and was finally gave birth to religion, which means to bind together, because that is precisely what its answers did for the community. So religion and its answers to life mysteries became the holy enterprise, the sacred pursuit that infused community with a sense of life, meaning, and purpose upon the earth. However, as population grew and communities proliferated, so did various religions. But one thing remained the same: the purpose for which society had created religion. Thus, whether it is a Jewish temple, an Islamic mosque, a Southern Baptist church, or a Unitarian Universalist congregation, they all have the same mission. They all exist for the same purpose, a purpose created by society itself. What then distinguishes between all of these religions? Their distinctions are that they all answer the compelling questions of mystery differently, thus giving different meaning to life and different direction to community. And all these differences become critical to human destiny. Indeed, they have essentially shaped the human drama. and still are. As a recent example, consider the world since September 11, 2001, an event initiated by Islamic fundamentalism. So at its beginning, religion gave meaning to life and direction to community that already existed. That is, the community already existed. So it was the community that created religion for its own sake and not vice versa. So the purpose of religion is not to create community. Nor is the purpose of religion to initiate social action programs. No need for social action programs when society created religion, unless you consider combating wild animals to be social action. This need only came about with the proliferation of both societies and religions and their consequent meaning competitions. In modern history, social action is a reflection of the religious community's beliefs. What religion does is define its beliefs and from this definition determine what issues of social action must best serve the community's mission of cultural transformation. In essence, rather than being the mission of religion, social action is the imperative arm of the religious community serving that mission. Now, here are some of the most vital of those questions emerging from the mystery of human existence, which are the primal concerns of religion. Who am I? Which is a question about the nature of my being. How do I know? Which is a question about my source of authority. Who or what's in charge? Which is a question about my ultimate value. What is my purpose? Which is a question about that which informs and sustains my sense of self-worth. And what does my death mean? Which is the question about the boundaries of time in my existence. The answers to these compelling questions create the core of a view of reality. And out of this view of reality emerge values that create individual and community conscience that give meaning to life and direction to living. A religious community is a group sharing a common view of reality. It is this view of reality that transcends differences, bonds the community in mutual allegiance. Now, if a religion dominates a culture, as Christianity has in Western history, then its values and its language will provide the foundational meanings and directions of that culture and serve as some major part of its conscience, depending on what political myth drives the culture's existence. And when this happens, that religion has been successful in fulfilling its mission. So I suggest to you, as liberals, and myself included, rather than resenting the religious right for being successful, we should make the same kind of investment that assures our own success. Go ahead, clap. All right. Now, flowing from these perceptions is the definition of the mission of religion in modern society. It is to transform the society in which it exists into the shape of its own view of reality and values conscience. And it does this by transforming enough of the individuals in that society into the image of its own answers to the compelling questions, with the end result that its own conscience prevails. It's called influence. And the tool it uses for this transformation is its answers to life's compelling questions. If it has no statement of common answers, it has no transforming tool. Here then is another governing truth of social existence. No society is ever transformed by any social action that is only designed to change its laws. Even though laws are educational tools and boundaries intended to restrain behavior, they're only kept by a nation's people if their conscience subscribes to these laws. This is a singular, most important lesson of the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. He was not interested in simply changing laws so that blacks could eat with whites at dime store lunch counters. He wanted to change the heart of our culture so that the mingling of blacks and whites in the same eating establishment would become an irrelevant issue. And his primary message was that if you want to change a culture's behavior in any sustainable manner, you first have to change the culture's heart that produces sustained behavior. Now we're into symptom and causes. In other words, you have to change the culture's answer to the compelling questions that are at odds with the behavior of racial respect and justice. You have to change his view of reality. You have to change his beliefs. To affirm this truth, I invite you to look at the history of the black population in America. This black population's civil rights were constitutionally secured in the late 1800s at the end of the Civil War, but these rights did not begin to become a social reality until the late 1900s, 100 years later. That is, these rights did not began to become a social reality until a significant segment of the cultural heart was brought into accord. And in our culture, it began with a change of heart of the Supreme Court. In brief, the Constitution and the laws of America have never been willingly kept except by those whose hearts believe in their efficacy. This means that the primal value of social action is that it raises a society's consciousness of the need to change its behavior. But here's the crucial point. Unless society is at the same time offered a message of transformation the society can use to change its heart, it will continue its behavior, and such social action will in finality be futile finger in the dike activity. This does not suggest that there's anything wrong with social action. Quite the contrary, and addressing critical issues and acting in ways that announce the need for social change is imperative. Social action is noble action, but such action becomes ultimately futile unless accompanied by a corresponding change of the cultural heart that produces a different behavior. And consider this the most profound form of community bonding and the most impactful social action is always driven by a clear and compelling mission. And the bonding that provides and the power of commonality. So the singular agent of human transformation possessed by religion is its answers to life's compelling questions of mystery, its beliefs, its commonly held view of reality. And the more committed to this commonality a religion is to, and more committed to this message, the more powerful a tool of social change it becomes. The opposite, of course, is equally true. The more diversified a religion's answers to the compelling questions, the greater is its social impotence. We've believed ourselves into impotence. So I repeat, our mission as a religious institution is individual and social transformation, a transformation that brings society into a greater accord with our answers to the compelling questions of human existence. And as a community of faith, it is to model this message so that the social order can actually see its transforming power at work. So it's not only message, it's model. Our challenge is to commit in fullness to this mission for which society created us. And at the heart of this challenge will be overcoming the fear that grips us religious liberals. Namely, that if we hold a common answer to anything profound, we will have created dogma and become like, you know, them. We may adore the notion of unity and diversity, however, it only fosters social impotence. Moreover, I suggest to you, it is false. Unity does not exist in diversity, it exists in commonality. And if we wish the social power to transform, then we must become enamored of the notion that diversity resides in unity. That is, unity is a singular source of both the capacity to embrace diversity and simultaneously express social power. The proper mantra is diversity in unity. Just to be sure you don't forget it, the moment I walk out the front door of the sanctuary, chant it with me three times. Are you ready? Here we go. Diversity in unity, diversity in unity, diversity in unity. Our misperception about diversity is as the focus of ministry is reminiscent of a Hagar the Horrible cartoon. It's a Viking boat. Some of the crew members are paddling with the blade of the oar, some with the handle of the oar, some are rowing forwards, some are rowing backwards, and the boat is moving in aimless circles and zigzags, and Hagar, standing at the helm with hands cupped around his mouth, is shouting, "Will you quit saying different strokes for different folks?" The underlying message of the cartoon captures a principle that governs all cultural life, that the power to move in concerted direction to create positive social change lies in commonality. Everybody rowing in the same direction. A few years ago at the National Gallery of Canada in Ottawa, I sat in the La Chapelle Redoux Chapel and listened to the Farty Port Motet, composed in 1575 by Thomas Tallis. Anybody familiar with one? Okay. You get a star. See me after the service. I was surrounded by 40 audio speakers, 8 set sopranos, 8 alto, 8 tenor, 8 baritone, 8 bass, each voice range and each set chanting a different part, yet every set harmonizing with all the other parts. The power that captured one's attention was not that of 8 sets devoted to a disparate cacophony of difference. Rather, it was engaging harmony of 8 varied sets devoted to a harmonious blended commonality. And again, I assert that the power to engage and transform society is found in commonality that unifies differences into powerful synergistic wholeness. How transforming it could be were we to actually devote our religious movement to the articulation of a message of redemption for a world bent on self-destruction. And we're not doing that. None of our meetings are devoted to that purpose. Maybe this congregation, I'm sure you're the exception to the rule. But not our religious movement as a whole. However, if this is going to happen, then it will be because we've decided to engage the mission for which society created us rather than to play safely around its edges lest we inadvertently step on a dangerous commonality. I was walking down the crowded hall of a hotel at one of our religious movement's national assemblies when a woman stepped up in front of me, stuck out her hand, smiled, introduced herself and said, "You have no reason to remember me, but 10 years ago I visited a Sunday service at your church. I was in a major life crisis, and your sermon helped me to make a decision that transformed my life. I just wanted to thank you." And with that, she turned and disappeared in the crowd, and I've never seen her since. Had I not been momentarily stunned by her words, I would have suggested she communicate her appreciation to the congregation she visited rather than to me, because I was only the speaker of their message that day. However, this incident continues to remind me of the awesome responsibility and the wonderful privilege of our religious mission, the responsibility to change the very being of our culture, the privilege of being the spiritual guide to its heart and conscience. The challenge before us is to pick up the mantle of our mission, to speak and model a message of transformation and offer redemption to a spiritually bankrupt and degenerating society. And in this respect, I offer one more observation. In order to be transforming, a religious institution must first be transformed by its own message. I conclude with three quotations that indicate the historical nature of what I have shared. R.F. Meagher vows, if you don't know where you're going, you're liable to end up someplace else. And from Alice in Wonderland, this dialogue. Cheshire Push, Alice began, would you please tell me which way I ought to go from here? That depends a great deal on where you want to get to, said the cat. I don't much care where, said Alice. Then it doesn't matter which way you go, said the cat. And Montaigne, no wind blows in favor of the ship without a port of destination. Let us be what society created us to be, that agent which transforms its own spiritual heart. And all the people said,
Amen.
Amen. Amen.